It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. June is National Adopt-A-Shelter Cat Month. A perfect time to talk about what makes felines such unique pets and how people can adopt. We also get a handle on their evolutionary history to understand what makes them tick. And, though it takes patience, train them to do anything from shake to high five. Do you have a question about something your cat does that you can't figure out? We've got a behaviorist here who might be able to help you out. Did you adopt a shelter cat? How has your relationship with that cat blossomed? Or maybe it hasn't. What do you love most about cats? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Heather Seidel is an animal behavior evaluator with the Wisconsin Humane Society. Heather, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, John.
It's National Adopt-A-Shelter Cat Month. For people considering getting a cat, why is adopting one from a shelter a good option?
Well, it's a great option since we know there's so many homeless pets that are looking for homes. And shelters have a large selection of many mixed breed cats, but we also have purebred cats in the shelters as well. And for example, if you adopt from the Wisconsin Humane Society, all of our cats are already spayed or neutered. They are microchipped, they've gone through a vet check, and they start out with their basic examination and shots. And if you adopt a cat that is 1 year and older, you get to name your own fee for the cat. So you can, you know, all the way up from $0 up to whatever you'd like to donate to the shelter. So it's a great option to find a home and add a new family member to your home.
There are certainly people who are staunchly non-cat people, but for those who are on the fence, tell us, what is it that makes cats such good pets?
Well, I think for one, I mean, there's nothing like having that little purring, you know, ball of fur on your lap. I find it very soothing, especially at the end of a tough day. They, you know, while they're not as necessarily as independent as a lot of people think, they are a little more independent than dogs. So I find it's a little easier if you don't want an animal always underfoot. They can, you know, they're pretty good at entertaining themselves for at least part of the day. And I think they just make great little companions. Again, you know, they can be very social. Like I said, there's a varying degree. Some cats are a little more independent, but some are quite social. So I think you know they're just a great addition to a home.
And there are what costs are associated with owning and caring for a cat?
Now, these can vary greatly depending on the age and specific needs of your cat, but we estimate the average cost of about $500 a year, and that would include your basic shots, basic veterinary care, food, toys, grooming supplies, and of course, if you adopt a cat shelter, you're going to save on having them spayed or neutered, which we highly recommend. So, you know, and then, you know, from there, you know, each, you know, the first year is probably the most expensive year getting set up with the cat. But about $500 for your general basic care is what you can anticipate.
A lot of people will just write off cats as being cold or aloof and that, well, they don't care about you. Some people would go so far as to say you can't own a cat. The cat owns you. How would you respond to that?
There might be a little bit of truth to that, but I do think there can be, there is a mutually beneficial relationship that can occur between, humans and people. A lot of people will ask, do cats sense our emotions? And I don't, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's some research on there out there on that and a little bit of debate. So they can, we know they can recognize our facial gestures like smiling or frowning. And they do tend to view our emotions more as what does this facial structure mean for me? So, you know, so maybe their motivations aren't quite the same as, say, a dog. But when we're happy, cats, you know, are likely to associate that with things that feel good to them. Like when we're happy, we're more likely to interact with our cats or give them treats. So I think, you know, they, you know, they're not necessarily as a loop. And again, there's a varying degree of cats who are independent versus more social. But a lot of that has to do with, you know, our response when we're around cats. You know, the more social, smiling, happy, welcoming we are, the more interactive a cat is going to be with us too.
Heather Seidel is with us. She's an animal behavior evaluator with the Wisconsin Humane Society. It's National Adopt a Shelter Cat Month, and we're talking about cats this morning on the morning show, wondering what you think. Are you a cat person? Did you adopt a shelter cat? How did that work out for you? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. The email is ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Maybe, what about training cats? Or have you found cats to be therapeutic? If you have, do you have a cat that's helped you get through a hard time? Do you know someone who's benefited from the company of a cat? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Heather, I want to rewind the clock a bit here. What do we know about the domestication of cats? When did they start becoming our pets? How did that happen?
The domestication started probably about, you know, 8,000 to 9,500 years ago. And that started more, you know, initially humans were predominantly hunters. And so dogs were very useful to us. So, you know, dogs were domesticated before cats. But when we began to settle down and people started doing, you know, started farming the land more, which also meant we were storing grain, when you start storing grains and other, you know, agriculture items, that can lead to mice and, you know, other rodents, and that then brought the cats, and that there created a great, you know, started to create a relationship between the cats and humans. You know, so the cats were attracted to the abundance of prey available in the storehouses, and of course people love the pest control. And then research suggests that the cats sort of domesticated themselves amongst humans. So it's like the cats invited themselves in, and then people favored, you know, we favored cats' docile traits. And then through that, certain cats adapted to the new environment, and then that led to producing the dozens of breeds of house cats we know today. So, you know, that's kind of what attracted cats to hanging around humans, was the mice. We like, you know, we thought they were very beneficial, and then, of course, we started, you know, forming our relationships based on the cats, you know, who are comfortable approaching humans.
Well, I think you might be able to make a case out of what you just said that maybe cats domesticated humans.
Yes, you could make a case for that. Yeah, you know, yeah, they certainly domesticated us towards them. Yeah.
I mean, a little bit later on, we're going to talk about training cats. And I have to admit that when this first came up in a meeting, when we were talking about this topic, I said, well, hang on a second. We can train cats? I thought it worked the other way around. a cat behaviorist wrote that dogs derive a sense of home and safety from their owner, while for cats, it's the physical place that they live. How true is that?
Well, it is true. You know, well, cats certainly form bonds with humans. You know, I know my cats are bonded to me. But they do not view their owners as their main provider of security and safety like dogs do. So cats, for them, a safe place is a private area where they can retreat and feel protected. So they're not going to maybe kind of, you know, hang on to us, lean up against us when they're feeling insecure. They would rather find, you know, retreat and find a place to hide. That helps them feel secure. And cats also like to be up high. When, you know, that gives them a great chance to observe their environment, especially when they feel frightened, and that way they can avoid surprises. So, well, maybe our dogs might look to us or kind of cling to us for security. A cat is more likely to want to hide or get up high so there's no surprises for them.
Our conversation with Heather Seidel continues in a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's National Adopt a Shelter Cat Month, and we're talking about what makes felines such unique pets and how we can train them. Do you have a question about something your cat does? Have you found cats to be therapeutic? Do you have a cat that helped you get through a tough time? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Heather Seidel is an animal behavior evaluator with the Wisconsin Humane Society. And we have callers who want to talk about cats this morning. Dan in Drummond is one of them. Dan, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
I have a friend that's she's got a adopted a barn cat, and the darn thing taught itself how to open up the doors so he could go outside. And he would reach up to the handle and pull it down, and he'd reach up to the handle on the outside door. So she ended up having to put hooks on so he couldn't do that.
Wow. What a great story, Dan. Thanks for sharing that. Heather, cats, pretty smart animals.
Oh, they're very smart, yeah. And I had a little trouble hearing, but I believe you're saying that, yeah, the cat that figured out how to open up a door.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's pretty common. Cats are very smart. In fact, they can learn from us, and they learn from us every day, whether we intend them to or not. So I've talked to many people whose cats have learned how to open up the doors just by watching us do that.
Wow. And no opposable thumbs. Can you imagine what would happen if they had that?
Yeah, we'd be in trouble.
Oh, big time. You know, just before the break, you were talking about cats and how they use their environment and how they experience it. I think that made me think, what's up with cats and boxes?
I think that's another one of those examples of having a smaller place where they can just kind of hide and retreat. You know, that they you know, that just is comforting to them. I think it's a comforting space to them.
Let's take another call. John is with us in Boaz. John, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Be careful. Little kittens will climb your draperies.
But I've seen that happen.
But we are humans, and we understand that. As a therapy cat, when my wife died from cancer, I was all alone, and a neighbor gave me a little kitten, and she was peach colored, like a tabby, orange tabby. And I raised her up from a little kit, and we got to be such good friends, you know, like man and cat, that we had a language where we could talk. Like I'd say, "Hi, Peachy," and she'd go, "Meow." And we had an understanding. Well, anyways, I said, "What am I going to do when I lose Peachy?" And I'd come to tears. Mm-hmm. But one day I lived in my hunting shack. It was 10 below zero out. I had no water, no electricity, no heat. And I climbed in two sleeping bags. I snuggled up and I put a wool army blanket on top. And I said, "I wonder where Peachy is." And 5 minutes later, I could feel her crawling. She found the hole in my sleeping bags, crawled in there, curled up on my tummy, and just slept.
Great story. John, thank you for sharing that with us. John, great experience there with a therapy cat who helped him overcome the loss of his wife. Heather, what about John's story? What kind of therapy do cats offer us?
Well, I think, again, it's just that sense of companionship. You know, and I always find, you know, I mean, I have cats and a dog at home, and I absolutely love my dog. But I do, there is just something, I think, special about when a cat chooses to curl up next to you or chooses to climb up on your lap and snuggle with you. You know, and I think a lot of it has to do, it's just that comforting little, you know, warm, furry body, that purring. I think that just offers a lot of comfort. And as we know, cats could probably do an okay job surviving without us. You know, they are natural born hunters, so they can hunt for their food. You know, again, as we were saying, they don't get a sense of security from people. So I think, to me, you know, it's just really special that these are, you know, little animals that choose to spend their lives with us. So I think that's special.
One thing that we just heard about is you know, kittens crawling the curtains. For those who might be a little leery about getting a cat as a pet because of some potential damage to drapes and furniture, is this something that people should be concerned about? And is this something you can train your cat not to do?
Oh, sure. I mean, you could pretty much train your cat to do or not to do many, many different things. But it is important to understand what a cat's natural tendencies are. And climbing and jumping is certainly natural traits that cats have. So it is a very common behavior when you have kittens to climb up curtains because they're good at climbing. So the best way, if you want to prevent that from happening, is provide them things they can climb in, such as a cat tower or a cat tree, because again, these are their natural inclinations. So we want to give them an alternative to our curtains, you know, such as a cat tree or a cat tower, which frankly would be a lot more satisfying for a cat to climb, because usually while they're climbing, again, they can do it, but they want to be up high. So if we provide something else for them, we can easily transition them from the curtains to that particular item instead.
How much more effort does it take to train a cat than, say, a dog?
I don't know that it necessarily takes more effort. The approach is different because cats aren't as motivated by praise, and they are less instinctively driven to work in partnership with humans like dogs are. But we can still, you know, work with them. And the most important thing is to make sure we're using positive reinforcement techniques, you know, so meaning when we want to a behavior to be repeated, we want to reward them with something that they actually like. And for cats, the easiest thing to use is food. You know, so you want, if you use some really high value food, and so you'll need to resign yourself that if you want to reinforce a behavior from a cat, you're going to want to use some high value food, maybe some diced chicken, turkey, low sodium tuna, something meat based that is very appealing to them. And then you want to be, you know, you want to be consistent with your training. You want to make sure you're clear. And if you're going, you know, you can train cats useful behaviors. For example, we can redirect them from climbing the curtains to climbing a piece of cat furniture, or we can teach them tricks too. You know, many cats can easily learn high five, sit, lie down. But the thing is again, you want to use that good reward, that's something that is rewarding to the cat, and be consistent with your training and keep your training sessions short. You don't want to go longer than about 10 or 15 minutes when you're teaching them something new.
Some people may have had a cat growing up or an interaction with a cat that wasn't so pleasant. Heather, can cats be, well, just bad? Or is there something else usually going on here when somebody has a bad experience?
I wouldn't want to say that cats can just be bad, but there certainly are many, you know, each cat is an individual, and they're going to have their own personalities or felinalities, if you will. So I think sometimes, you know, it can, and cats have long memories. So sometimes, you know, if a cat experienced something unpleasant younger in life, that can stick with them. And that might be something that can hinder a human and cat relationship, you know, or there could be something going on in the environment where the cat is feeling insecure or they're just not feeling comfortable and safe in their environment. And that can, you know, that can cause them to react in a not so friendly way. You know, so certainly, you know, I think, you know, and fear can be a big motivator for a cat not being friendly or not, you know, wanting to avoid people. And then the other thing is sometimes there can be something medically going on with the cat that makes them not the friendliest to be around. So those are things we'd want to check out. You know, is there something fearful, stressful, or medically going on with the cat?
For those who might be ready to get the wheels in motion to adopt a cat, what should they know? What sorts of research should they do?
Well, I recommend, you know, now we have the internet, so certainly, you know, get online, learn all you can about cats, read books, and start at home. You know, talk to, you know, if you have a family and you guys are thinking about adding a cat, it's important, I think, to talk to everyone in the family about what characteristics appeal to you about the cat, be they physical, but most importantly, what type of personality will best suit your home and your lifestyle. So start there at home, what everyone's expectations are for a cat, and then search the internet, read books on cats. And when you come to a shelter, there are adoption counselors who can help you, you know, can take that information and kind of guide you through which cats might be a good match for you and your family. And your lifestyle, too. That's important as well.
And where can people go if they want to learn more about how to adopt a cat from the Wisconsin Humane Society?
You can visit our website at www.wihumane.org. And once you're on our website, you can click on the Adopt tab at the top of the page. And for any of the listeners who are not located near one of our campuses, we also have a list of other shelters in the state of Wisconsin.
And people can find a link to that website at WPR.org. And once again, you mentioned this just about at the top of the show. What does it cost to adopt?
We've cost to adopt, so the fees range from $99 up to $199 for kittens that are under 1 year old. But cats 1 year and older, it's a name-your-own adoption fee.
All right. Find out more about this on the Morning Show page at WPR.org. Heather Seidel, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Heather is an animal behavior evaluator with the Wisconsin Humane Society. Coming up, we learn why we need to offer culturally sensitive health care to Wisconsin's growing Amish population. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin has the fourth largest Amish population in North America. More settlements develop every year, and we're learning more about Amish culture and health care. Our guests explain their latest research on these populations and why culturally sensitive health care is important. Do you live near an Amish settlement? What's it like living near an other culture? What have you discovered about this population that you didn't know before? And has the Amish population grown where you live? Do you work in healthcare? Have you had Amish patients before? How did you make your patient feel more at ease? What did you learn from the experience? Share your stories with us at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is our email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Joshua Brown is an associate professor of German and linguistics at UW-Eau Claire. He teaches a course called Amish in North America. Josh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much.
Also with us is Nora Erth. Nora Erth Kindry, who is the Associate Professor of Nursing at UW-Eau Claire. Nora, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Nora and Josh served as faculty mentors of a UW-Eau Claire student-run research project called Languages and Nursing Transcultural Nursing Care within the Chippewa Valley Amish community. Josh, let's start with you. Why does Wisconsin have such a large Amish population?
Wisconsin's a great place for the Amish to be for a number of reasons. One of the biggest reasons is that we're kind of a feeder state of migration from other states, places like Iowa, Ohio, Indiana, places where the Amish can be a little bit more conservative. They'll leave their progressive settlements in those states and come to Wisconsin. Wisconsin has great dairy farming, as we know, dairy farming opportunities. There are really important infrastructure systems in place in Wisconsin that allow the Amish to come here. But the Amish have been expanding all throughout North America considerably. So Wisconsin is just one of the places that they end up.
What do you mean by infrastructure?
There are certain systems in place that Wisconsin has. So like local laws, I would say, for example, that enable Amish people to have a little bit more freedom than they would in other places like Pennsylvania, for example. So in Pennsylvania, there are certain laws that exist about buggy regulations, about road buggies on roads, anything like septic tanks and things like that, that Wisconsin is typically a little bit more progressive with, a little bit more relaxed with, that allows for the Amish to remain in their lifestyle that's a little bit out of step with mainstream society.
Nora, let's talk a little bit about health care. What parts of the state do we see health care being more accessible to Amish population? And are there some places that stand out to you?
The Amish are a group of people that look at only entering the healthcare system when there is something terribly wrong. They're not a group of people that use prevention and in healthcare systems unless there's a need for it. And because they don't have health insurance, they have to pay out of pocket for the services that they do enter into the healthcare system to obtain. So we have several hospitals in our community here, and the Amish utilize them infrequently to take care of the needs that they have, mostly from accidents or very serious illness that sort of forces them into the healthcare system, because for the most part, the Amish will try to take care of their health through alternative and complementary medicine.
Josh, the Amish population isn't just one category. This is a diverse people, but they're broken down into groups. What are Amish groups called, and how do they differ from one another?
Well, there are three main types of Amish. There's the Old Order Amish, the New Order Amish, and the Beachy Amish, or Amish Mennonites. And Wisconsin, we have New Order Amish, and we also have Old Order Amish. We have a very small population of New Order Amish around Spencer in Marathon County, Marathon and Clark County. And the New Order Amish have horse and buggy on Sundays. They can drive ATVs during the week, but they emphasize Bible study, so a cognitive approach to their religious orientation. The Amish that we have mostly in Wisconsin are the Old Order Amish, and we have all different types of Old Order Amish. So one of the most surprising things that people hear is that, you know, that there is this diversity that exists among the Amish. And we have, everybody thinks that Amish buggies in Wisconsin are black. That's not true. We have gray buggies in Wisconsin in places like Owen and Withy, and even south in the state in places like Lancaster, Wisconsin, and in Lafarge. So we have, those would be Eastern Old Order Amish. We have Western Old Order Amish that drive black buggies. We have some of the most conservative Amish in the world that are called the Schwarzentruber Amish throughout the state. And all of those groups would not really interact with each other. That's another surprising thing that people learn about Amish diversity, is that not all Amish people can necessarily intermarry, will fellowship together, will go to each other's worship services. It really depends on how they identify themselves on a religious continuum.
Nora, I understand that you have lived near an Amish population in Wisconsin in the past. What were your takeaways from that experience?
I lived around in the Hillsboro area for about a year, and I learned that you drive very slowly, especially on date night, so that you avoid hitting buggies as you come around windy corners in that part of the state. I also learned that the Amish are very friendly, approachable people, very interested in being good neighbors, and have a strong work ethic. In fact, I just finished reading a book about the sort of the undercurrent that the Amish children versus the English, which we're all called if we're not Amish, that Amish children are better behaved than our English children because of their sense of purpose and worth in the community. They know exactly what they're doing and have chores and are welcomed as a valuable part of that community. So I think community is a huge thing for the Amish, and people stay in the Amish culture because they do have an opportunity when they're about 16 years of age to leave that culture if they choose to. And the majority of them stay in that culture because of that sense of welcoming community that they have.
Josh, you've said that most of those who are Amish have about an eighth grade education level. How much does that impact their knowledge of health and what it means to be healthy?
It impacts it to a significant extent, I would say. They may not be aware of some of the more intricate details of recognizing certain health scares, like a stroke, heart attack, or things like that. But, I mean, mainstream society is also pretty unaware of certain things. You know, if recognizing a stroke, we've all seen those billboards as well, as just one example. So, their eighth grade education is not necessarily a limiting factor in understanding healthcare. It's more of a misinformation of getting the information to the Amish that's the biggest hurdle. It's not that they're, you know, against getting this information. They're completely open to getting the information. It just kind of takes an extra step with healthcare providers to provide that additional education point to it.
Nora, what have you heard from nurses who've worked closely with the Amish? You mentioned earlier that that preventive care isn't high on their list, but how open are the Amish populations to medical treatment?
I don't really have a statistic on how often the Amish enter the healthcare system. And our project, working with a couple of nursing students with the Eau Claire City County Health Department here, and so one of the public health nurses is assigned to that group, but we have a larger population in the Augusta area. And she and the students and I and Josh have talked about, well, what is it, the areas of health that they need help understanding? And some of those top areas were the use of supplements, because they do home herbal remedies and understanding what those are. So when they do enter the healthcare system, we know now that we're not just supposed to say, oh, I take this medication for my blood pressure, but I also taking vitamin E, because vitamin E thins my blood. So we need to know about those things. Oral health is another concern. The Amish population, as Josh says, it's not because they're not willing to do these preventive things. It's about the education part of it. So my understanding from the public health nurse here in Eau Claire County is that most people by the age, Amish people by the age they're 25, have lost the majority of their teeth. And immunizations is another area that encourage. There's a cost with immunizations, and so expense is important for them when they're considering when to enter the healthcare system. And the whole maternal child health with prenatal care. Apparently, there's just about one prenatal visit, which is very different from what we do in the English world, where we see the expecting mom many times. So there's many areas of health that we can help them know more about to take care of themselves.
Josh, whether it's preventive care, emergency treatment, or dental care, everything has a price tag. Do Amish populations have insurance, and how do they pay if they don't have it?
So that varies from group to group, and it varies from individual family to individual family. So there are a number of children that have chronic disorders, or maybe genetic disorders that require extensive care, and they are enrolled in Badger Care in the state. Not completely publicly, I would say, but there are a few that happens. And the reason is because they're children and they're not members of the church yet. They're not members of the church until they're baptized later as adults. And,
Well, let's pick that up when we come back. We're going to continue our discussion with Josh Brown, Associate Professor of German and Linguistics at UW-Eau Claire, Nora Erth-Kindry, Associate Professor of Nursing at UW-Eau Claire. They mentored UW-Eau Claire's student-run research project called Languages and Nursing, Transcultural Nursing Care within the Chippewa Valley Amish Community, and we're hearing about what they learned. Our conversation continues in a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Wisconsin has the fourth largest Amish population in North America. More settlements develop every year, and we're learning more about Amish culture and healthcare this morning on the morning show. Our guests are explaining their latest research on these populations and on the importance of culturally sensitive healthcare. Do you live near an Amish settlement? What's that like? And what have you discovered about this population that you never knew before? And how has this population grown where you live? Maybe you're Amish. What do you want people to know and understand about your culture? You find healthcare access easy or difficult? How welcoming are clinics and hospitals in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Josh Brown is an associate professor of German and linguistics at UW-Eau Claire. Nora Erth-Kindry is an associate professor of nursing at UW-Eau Claire. Josh and Nora mentored a UW-Eau Claire student-run research project called Languages and Nursing: Transcultural Nursing Care Within the Chippewa Valley Amish Community. And continuing our conversation with them. Nora, why is cultural sensitivity so important in healthcare?
It's very important because we're all individual people. We do have cultural, I guess we think of populations from different characteristics and perspectives. And so understanding where a person comes from is very important in providing the care. From my perspective, holism, practicing with body, mind, spirit, taking all those factors into account means that we understand the person and how they're, what we call in public health, the social determinants of health impact them. So the environment that someone lives in, their religious beliefs that they have, the number of amount of money that they make. I'm not sure if you're aware, but zip code makes us more healthy versus genetic code. So where we live is really impactful on our health. So understanding the background of someone and where they come from is very important to taking care of people.
Josh, some medical clinics in Wisconsin are tailored to treating Amish communities. What are they doing in particular to welcome the Amish?
Well, there's a birthing clinic in the southern part of the state, the Lafarge Clinic, that is set up to kind of mirror an Amish home, really, because a lot of Amish women give birth in their homes. So they have it set up that, there's not, when you walk into the room, you don't see electronics first. They're kind of hidden. They have, quilts around. There are also other clinics in Wisconsin that are tailored to the Amish. Something as simple as putting up a hitching post outside is a really effective way of tailoring to a local Amish community.
Both of you mentored two UW-Eau Claire students through a research project that we've referred to before, the Languages and Nursing: Transcultural Nursing Care Within the Chippewa Valley Amish Community. Nora, what was the purpose of this particular project?
Well, Josh and I wrote the project in mind with trying to do two things. One was to mentor nursing students and students in general through the university so that we're thinking more broadly about our future professions and how we can network and be part of a community. And we were looking at, one, how do we help healthcare providers in our community be more culturally sensitive to the Amish? And number two is, how do we help the Amish people be aware of all the resources that are available to us. So we wanted to try to help both sides of the community and also help students that are just growing and coming into their own professions so they can reach out and make their communities better.
Josh, what was your role as a mentor in this project?
So I was basically the one who identified the students. In my course, there are a number of nursing students that take it because they're interested in looking at being more culturally responsive to their patients. And so I identified the students that we could work with, and then I was the one who kind of started out the semester with talking about just a general background on the Amish, and then a little bit on Amish healthcare, so that then Nora could take over and work with the Eau Claire County, a city county public health nurse, in deciding how we can best get education materials out there for healthcare providers on the Amish population.
Nora, how did you go about researching healthcare in Amish communities? What did that entail?
There was connecting with the Eau Claire City County Public Health Department and then looking at the literature, and also being in nursing, it's great that everything that we do, I think, impacts health. And so in the other courses that I teach, I've had a Doctor of Nursing Practice student doing her final project around the Amish culture in increasing newborn screenings in Clark County, because she used to be a public health nurse in that area. And then I've had other nurses that share stories, anecdotes, anecdotally in class. For example, someone that worked as a paramedic while she's in nursing school and had to go out to an Amish farm, and just her explaining this different structure of the houses. There's no lights. You have to have flashlights. How do we get the stretcher up these narrow stairs? Understanding that they don't have English as the primary language either. So we have health illiteracy concerns and maybe language concerns. And so there's so much to know about the Amish culture.
Josh Brown is an associate professor of German and linguistics at UW-Eau Claire. Nora Erth-Kindry is associate professor of nursing at UW-Eau Claire. Josh, what was it you were looking to learn from this research project?
I was just looking really to learn about the healthcare aspect here in the Chippewa Valley. So, you know, what are the major concerns, to hear those from the public health nurse? What types of things does she advocate for here among the Amish populations? And so it was really, you know, fascinating for me to learn about the supplements being an issue here, oral health being an issue here, prenatal care being an issue, and how she kind of navigated that was really fascinating for me from a different standpoint. You know, she's someone that goes in and deals with Amish populations in a very different way than I do. So that was really the most fascinating part for me was to approach it from the healthcare standpoint.
Nora, how do we change our perceptions of other cultures, such as the Amish? How can we be more accepting?
I think that goes back to my areas in public health, and social justice is the philosophy that underlines public health, and that is that all humans have worth, regardless of all those things that we read about in disclaimers, gender, age, socioeconomic status, religion, that I think very broadly, you can apply social justice to all populations, so that if we just value other people for who they are, I think that goes a long way, just taking the time. And as I mentioned, I was reading that book earlier about children being raised in the Amish culture, and time just seems to slow down in the Amish world compared to the way we do. In fact, when I finished reading the book, I came away thinking, it might be nice to join that kind of lifestyle when you're not looking at technology or worrying about, you know, answering a different media sort of things. And so just being open, welcoming, looking mm-hmm. at people, listening, I think that's important.
Josh, what can you say about the way mainstream society depicts Amish populations? What are the biggest misunderstandings and misconceptions here?
I think that we're fed a lot of misconceptions. You know, you can turn on TV and you see Amish Mafia, Breaking Amish, all of these shows that give us a very skewed image of who the Amish are. And there are these romance novels that are very popular. You can pick them up at airports that have been on the New York Times bestseller list. And they portray the Amish in a very romantic way. They portray the Amish in a very skewed way. And so it's important for people to realize that, you know, Amish are human beings. They have vices and virtues just like everybody else. We shouldn't necessarily romanticize them. We shouldn't necessarily hold them up to some higher moral standard than the rest of us or sensationalize them. And I think that goes for really anybody in anywhere, mm-hmm. really, not just in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that sounds like a great place for us to leave this topic. Thank you so much for joining us. Josh Brown is Associate Professor of German and Linguistics at UW-Eau Claire. Thank you for joining us, Josh.
Thanks so much.
And Nora Erth-Kindry is Associate Professor of Nursing at UW-Eau Claire. Nora, thank you for being here this morning.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
They joined us from WPR's regional studios in Eau Claire. Just ahead, the Wisconsin Supreme Court reinstates most of the lame duck laws approved by the GOP in December. We'll hear about that in a moment. This is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent.